How many of you either currently or have been through a season where you're kind of afraid of the dark? Or you remember maybe your children at some point being kind of afraid of the dark? That's a typical thing. Why are we afraid of the dark? And we're not throwing the catch box today. Oh, by the way, Adam, can we get a little more light?
Yeah,
no problem. Tyler's like our man. You know Tyler? Tyler knows everything. He knows all tech related. And so Adam's filling in for Tyler. That's probably more than enough. So thanks. So why are we, I see what you were doing there. The darkness thing. That was good. Solid. Solid. So why are we afraid of the dark? What's the deal behind that? Give us some ideas. Just shout it out right now and I'll repeat it.
Unknown.
The unknown. Yeah. What else? Yeah, something could sneak up on you.
Monsters,
right? I've got a 7-year-old, and 9 nights out of 10, I'm on all fours, looking under the bed still. What's that? You're blinded. You can't see what's. Yeah. Yeah. What's that?
Nothingness.
Is that what you said? Yeah. Yeah. Solid. Yeah. Right. Nothingness. There's this. This unknown. You know what's really interesting? In all these, there are scientific studies. What makes humans different than everything else, than everybody else? And we say, well, we've got the ability to reason and all of this. But more and more, as they're trying to figure out, but what's the opposable thumbs? Yeah, Dwayne. Nope, not even that. Beyond all of these things of what sets humans apart from other people is this fascinating reality that researchers are saying, you know what, the biggest, maybe most foundational difference is that human beings, as far as we can tell, are the only living things that can envision the future. They can think about possibilities. And because we can envision the future, this wonderful gift, we call it our imagination, because we have this great imagination, what can we do? We can come up with every bad scenario in the world, right? So we're the only creatures that are capable of living in constant fear as well. All right? So we've been talking about during our Lent season. So the Lent season is the 6 weeks that lead up to Easter. And often it's a bit more somber. It's a bit more quiet. We embrace that sometimes in really intense ways. We've been doing that in little ways throughout these weeks. But one of the ways that the church has always understood Lent is that it parallels the time that Jesus spent in the wilderness for 40 days. And so it's a time where Jesus is experiencing the raw realities of humanity, of longings, of hungers, of temptations, of all of these things in the wilderness and connecting with what his identity is all about. And eventually, as if you know the story, it's got a good ending. Jesus wins. Eventually, what the story goes is that Jesus is able to be so secure in his identity that he can handle all of these challenges to who he is, and will he be able to continue to trust the Father in this path that he's walking. And so we've decided that this time around for us, these 6 weeks, we're going to spend the entire week or the entire season on one psalm. And that one psalm is the most famous psalm that David wrote, the 23rd psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." And so we've been looking at this, and this is something we never, ever do, but we've been doing one verse each week. Instead of talking about big topics or talking about a whole story, we've been dwelling on one verse each week to say, what does it mean to learn what David was talking about and to see its fulfillment in God? And so this psalm about God being a shepherd, we've given you kind of a modern version to kind of reflect on. And we said, you know, we gave you little cards at the beginning. If you haven't gotten one, there should be some still in the back. But we say, read it out loud every single day. It only takes less than 60 seconds. And let it start to work its way into your bones. There's a story that was circulated in the early 1900s about this event where they were looking at the 23rd Psalm and they had a professional actor come up and kind of read the psalm in David's spirit and heart. And then they had someone share, a pastor shared later. And a little boy was watching with his father. And the actor came up and he displayed the power of this psalm in unbelievable ways with the depths of David and everything like that. And everybody at the end, when he was done, they stood up and they gave him a standing ovation. And then the pastor walked up. And the pastor looked at the crowd and he shared the exact same words of the exact same psalm. And when he was done, nobody clapped. But there were a ton of people crying. And so the little boy, on his own with his dad, afterwards said, "Daddy, how come when the actor went up and did it, everybody applauded, but when the pastor went up and did it, everybody cried?" And the father looked at him and he said, "Well, son, the actor knew the psalm, but the pastor knew the shepherd." And something different happens, and this is a beautiful piece of literature. It's a beautiful piece of literature, but something different happens when we begin to engage not with the ideas of it, but with the shepherd himself. And when we understand this, not in light of this was a cool thing David did or thought of because he had shepherding experience, but this actually is my shepherd. This is the nature and the character of my God. And so as we lean into that, it should strike us in a personal way, and there's a reason that I'm specifically talking about that this week. But, okay, so we're just going to hop in to verse 4, which is all about, you guessed it, darkness and fear, okay? So here's the verse. "Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me. Your rod and your staff protect and comfort me." Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I won't be afraid because you're close beside me and your rod and your staff protect and they comfort me. The word for, let's just start with the first part of the phrase. The word for walk is really interesting because we've all experienced intense valleys in our lives. We've all experienced times that feel like darkness. In the most famous version, it's "even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death." You've heard that, right? Death is not actually mentioned here in the original Hebrew. The word, the halak, or the word of walking, is a word of journeying through something, not arriving or landing at something. So it's really interesting that the first thing that David is saying is, you know, I'm on this journey, and there, as a part of this journey, I'm going through places. I don't stop here. I don't stop in the valley, but it's a part of my journey. So I'm going through something. So there's movement that's related. And then the valley of the shadow of death literally means the deepest darkness. Even when I walk through the deepest darkness, okay? So any time that you're walking through deep darkness, it feels like death, doesn't it? There feels like there's death close by. The reason that we have so much trouble with the dark is that our ultimate fear of something going to get us. I remember when I was 19 was when I started backpacking, and I did my first solo trip, and I went out into the woods overnight on my own. And so I'm 19, and I think I'm really old. And all of you who have parents of kids that are 19, you're like, yeah, they don't know what they're doing. They're not old at all. But so my mom was really worried about me. I was in my first year of college, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to be great. Do you understand how capable I am, Mom? And so I go out, and I was on a 30 or 40 mile trip overnight. And the first night that I camp out in the woods, I am shaking, terrified every minute, because you hear these things outside, whether it's like a squirrel or a little bird rustling, you know, and you immediately think that thing is going to kill me. On the East Coast, when we have, it's all mind over matter, right? We know that that's not going to happen, you know? Squirrel attack, you know, 2019 leaves Northern Delaware man, you know, maimed on his pinky. You know, like, this is just not going to happen, but that doesn't keep our minds and our attitudes from just going off the deep end sometimes. Anytime we experience fear, it feels like death is nearby. Or even if it's not the physical thought of, oh my goodness, I'm going to die, it's the idea that something feels dead. I feel like I don't have hope. I feel like this, the worst thing that I can imagine is going to come. And it's really, really hard to leave that. And so David is talking about these moments. He's not talking about these moments from just an imaginative standpoint, though. David has been through, we think that when he was writing this, David had already become king. So he was a shepherd, and then he was a harpist for Saul after he had kind of been anointed that he would one day be king. Saul, it's this, you know, fortuitous thing where he moves into this area. Eventually, there's this transition, but then Saul wants to kill him because Saul was power hungry at the time. And so Saul goes after David, and David runs away. He runs to the land of the Philistines, and he hides. And what he goes is he ends up going into this hill country. And when he's in this hill country, he has to hide in these caves. Adullam is one of them, called Kish is another one. And so he's hiding in these caves. Sometimes he has men with him, sometimes he doesn't. But the only way to get there was to cross through all these hill countries that were highly dangerous because there were animals there, there were bandits, there were all these things. So David is acutely aware of what it feels like to walk through a literally dark valley where there is danger. Got it? So whether or not he's writing this at that point or later when he becomes king, either way, he's intimately acquainted with real danger, not just fake danger, but real danger, but also the power of what it feels like to walk through. This is all in 1 Samuel 22, 27, if you want to check it out later. So in the midst of this time, though, David also is keeping with this shepherding metaphor, and so he's remembering, though, in the midst of walking through all these terrifying things, maybe he's in a cave at the time, maybe he's in his, what's a king dwell in? Palace, thanks. I was going to say, he didn't have a castle. Why couldn't come up with a word? So maybe he's dwelling in his palace. And so what ends up happening is he begins, we can just imagine, to think back about his sheep while he's engaging with this real fear in his life. And he remembers that in his culture, a shepherd would summer in his own sheep pen. Okay, so they would have, in the valleys, they would have the places that they would keep their sheep for a long period of time. And then when the summer months got hot and all of the grass started to dry up, that was when it was time to leave. At least a good shepherd would always take his sheep out and they would go on this massive journey. And the places that they would go would be to the mountain pastures. They would go up to the green valleys where the elevation was higher, the land wasn't as arid, and there was green, lush grass. And so modern day shepherds talk about how the sheep love those pastures, and so a good shepherd needs to let his land regenerate, so he takes them on this journey. But the only journey to get to the high places, the only way to get to the high places, is to go through the ravines and up the valleys. You can't get there any other way. And so Philip Keller, who wrote a book called The Shepherd Looks at the 23rd Psalm, he talks about how one of the fascinating things is that in order to go to the high places, you have to pass through the dark valleys. There's simply no other way to get there. And one of the great paradoxes is it's in the valleys where you feel like there's the most danger and the most fear that is also where all the water runs. So it's the place that you find nourishment for your journey to the high places. So not that those are good experiences all the time, but he says, you know what, regardless of if you look at it as good or bad, you can't experience the highest places without walking through those valleys, without walking through valleys that feel like darkness, that feel like death. And so David's reflecting on all of this, and he's thinking about how he cared for his own sheep on the way up. And so he says, even though I walk through the darkest valley, he says, even there, I'm not going to be afraid, for you are close beside me. Okay, community participation. What do you notice if you've been journeying with us for a few weeks or even if you've just been looking? What just happened? Anybody? In this psalm? The Lord is my shepherd. I have nothing. He makes me lie down in green fields. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Yeah. Yes, yes. And what happens now? Right, right. So all of a sudden, in the middle of the psalm, Paul moves from poetry to prayer. So, Paul, where'd that come from? Thank you. Somebody, if you hear me say that, you have to tell me. I hate when I do that kind of thing. So David moves from this poetic, beautiful image, and all of a sudden, he's talking to the shepherd. Why? Why does it happen here? I think it happens here because something like passing through a dark valley when you're terrified is so intimate, is so personal, that David can't keep the distance of a third-person description anymore. He can't look at this and say say as if he's the actor up on stage, God is my shepherd. And God and he and all of this out there, and all of a sudden it's I won't be afraid when I pass through the deepest, scariest, intense moments of my life, because and he just can't say he. Or because the shepherd. Instead, he exclaims, because you are with me. You are with me. It's this beautiful moment. You are close beside me. It's almost unintentional that David can't even do anything. All of a sudden, there's a new imagination happening, right? He's remembering the shepherding, but he's remembering how he, when he was a shepherd, killed a bear and a lion when things got intense and when there was a threat. He's remembering that he, as a shepherd, always put his sheep first, always made sure that he was responsible for their well-being. So David, all of a sudden, begins to imagine not the worst-case scenario, but the best-case scenario, and he begins to see and say, you care about me even more than I used to care about my sheep, and I put my life on the line to care for and protect and love my sheep, to make sure that they were going to be okay. And so all of a sudden there's this declaration, even when I'm walking through the darkest valley, the deepest, worst parts of my life, I'm not going to be afraid because you are close beside me. It's beautiful. Okay, so next up, we're going to keep going because then we're going to have fun at the end. So your rod and your staff protect and comfort me. That's the next phrase. So to understand this, the rod was a shepherd's multi-tool, okay? So the rod was not, it wasn't big and long. It was about the size of maybe a club. And young shepherds would carefully go out and find a young sapling tree, and they would begin to dig it down to its root that was maybe about, I don't know, 2-3 inches in diameter. And they would start to cut it out, and they would, while it was still green, they would shave it just so it fit your hand just perfectly. And then they would dry it out like that, and they would carve it. This was something very special, and it was used for a number of different ways. But even today, in like Maasai lands, like places in Africa and up in Egypt, you can see young boys, shepherds, that are practicing. We would throw a football or a baseball, and what they do is they shoot a slingshot, right? They pick rocks and trees and bushes, and they throw their rods. Practice. Doing that. And so the rod would be used for defending against predators and everything like that. But there were two other uses for the rod that are really interesting for a shepherd. The first one is that if the sheep would get themselves into trouble, you would throw the rod at the sheep and you'd knock them across the head and they'd be like, oh, get back in line. So it was used to correct, okay? But it was also used, really interestingly, it was also used, if you've ever heard of the phrase pass under the rod, how many of you are familiar with that phrase? Some of you? Okay, it originally comes out of the book of Ezekiel, and God is speaking through Ezekiel about his love and care in contrast to how Israel's people had been selfish and exploited the poor and everything like that. And so he says in Ezekiel, I will take note of you as you pass under my rod. I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. Passing under the rod was a way that they made sure that they counted and had every sheep safe at the end of the night. So they would bring them back into the pen or whatever rock outcropping they were keeping them in, and they would keep the rod 1, 2, 3, 4, and they would make sure that everyone was accounted for. But in addition to making sure that they were accounted for, the rod was also a tool when the wool was really thick. You would actually pass the rod over the sheep, and you would part its wool and make sure that there were not parasites on the skin or any wounds or anything like that. It was a tool for close examination. You see what I mean by a shepherd's multi-tool? So anyways, the sheep, so David is saying here in this perspective, the fact that I know that you are carefully keeping an eye on me, even correcting me when the time comes, but also examining me closely. In Psalm 139, David says, search my heart, O God, and know all of my ways, know my anxious thoughts, and if there's anything in me that doesn't like show love for you, that doesn't honor you, then redirect me. Lead me in the fullness of all the ways. So David believed that was a good thing. I think it's really, really hard for us to talk about correction. I think it's really difficult for us to talk about how it can be a really good thing to feel like we miss the mark sometimes because God makes us aware of it, but it can be an incredibly good thing. We'll talk about that in a second. So next up, we've got the rod and the staff. So the staff, we've got a little example of one here. The staff is a really interesting tool because it's the most noticeable of all shepherding tools. This is the one that defines the shepherd. Even though the rod has many uses, it's the staff that nothing else, no other herder uses. It's not used for any other animal. It's only used for sheep. And this was never used as a weapon. This was never used to harm, even in correction. What the staff would be used for was always to rescue and to guide. There were three uses of the staff. One is if a sheep falls, bloop, you pull it out. In a ravine, a river, whatever, it could reach and rescue. The second thing is you would use it on the side of the animal as it would walk along dangerous places just to guide it, like a fence, like an ongoing fence of your lead sheep. But the other thing that I find really interesting is that that modern day shepherds talk about if they have a favorite sheep, like a pet sheep, and they do, you know, ones that they love, you know, whatever. When they're sitting on rocks or whatever, as a shepherd, this becomes an extension of the hand, and they'll just rest it on the sheep or on the side of the sheep. And they say the sheep love that. They love knowing that the shepherd's staff is right against them. That is just saying, I care about you deeply. You're special to me. And so the staff is this really fascinating thing. So David looks and he reflects and he says, I'm not going to be afraid even when I'm walking through areas of absolute uncertainty or whatever, because the rod and the staff bring comfort. Jesus has this unique and amazing ability to help people experience the most massive amounts of growth and the most massive amounts of love at the same time. And here's what, let's make a matrix. I love this. So we're going to draw, not like the matrix, just a matrix. No pills, no red and blue pills. Okay, so what we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about the culture that Jesus creates with his disciples. Okay, so Jesus creates this culture where there is a level of support and a level of challenge. Okay, support means I love you all the time. I am always on your side. Challenge means I want to shape you in a healthy way, and sometimes that means saying things that have to feel like correction, okay? So here's what happens. If we have a culture where there is very little support, this is a minus sign, very little support and also very little challenge, okay, then all that we're going to be is isolated. We're just going to feel alone. There's no guidance and there's no presence, neither of them. So we just feel isolated. We just feel kind of like, I'm sitting here, there's no movement, there's no support and encouragement, there's nothing. So we just ignore that. If we have this level over here of high support, so much love, but no challenge, okay, then what we have is we have this directionless world. Direction, list, there we go. So we're directionless if we feel a lot of love, but there's no movement. There's no knowing where to go. It's just nice, but it's cozy, but not cozy in like the Friday night movie type of a way. Cozy like, I guess this is it. Pass me more popcorn forever. Okay, so this is not the way to go. But if we have a culture that is really high challenge, but that is not high support, okay? So and some of you have grown up in households that had a ton of challenge and very little support. You knew what was expected of you. You just weren't sure that you were loved if you didn't live up to that, okay? And so what we get here is we just get this culture of complete exhaustion where we feel like we are never, we're never good enough. We never earn the love that we long for. But if we have a culture that is truly high in support and love and encouragement, where we know beyond the shadow of a doubt that someone has our back, that someone is encouraging, that somebody is on our side, but also someone that encourages us and challenges us to continue to grow and move, then what we get is this upper quadrant. And that is where we both experience comfort and growth. Now, I'll be honest, the most important one here is support, because over on this side, this is where fear just completely reigns. There we go. Anyways, what we end up with is this world. There's this great example with Jesus in Matthew 16. Jesus asks Peter about, through all that you're hearing, who do you think that I am? And Peter just like exclaims, I believe that you are the Son of God. And Jesus is like, this was not made known to you just by people. You're actually in touch with the heart of God. You heard this from God. It's true, and I'm going to encourage you. Do you understand, Peter, how much I believe in you? I'm going to build the church. Your name is Peter Petros, and I'm going to build this church, or I'm going to build this church on the rock. He's playing with words, because Petros and Peter both, they mean rock. So he's having fun with it. And the gates of hell will not overcome it. There's this amazing, amazing conversation. It's got to be one of the highest moments of Peter's life. Jesus believes in him. You know what happens 7 verses later? Let's see. Let's find out, friends. So, 5 verses later. It's like 7 sentences. I think I counted earlier. Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me. You don't have to mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Well, that'll pop your balloon. So, and what happens is that Jesus talks about the way that the way of God is going to be laying down his own life. And Peter's like, nope, we're not doing that. Peter was a bit of a zealot. He's like, let's kill the enemies instead of be killed by them. And Jesus is like, that's not how this whole thing is going to work. And so when Peter says, no, we're not going to, we will definitely not let this happen to you. And Jesus says, hold on, you're completely missing the heart of God here. And so here's the thing, though. Somehow, and if you know the story, you know that Peter later would deny Jesus on the weekend of Jesus' crucifixion. So here's the crazy thing that happens. Somehow, after all of that, Peter is completely dejected, but Jesus rises from the dead, not to let the cat out of the bag. We're going to celebrate that in a couple weeks. But Jesus has the resurrection, and we don't hear much from Peter for a little while. But then when Jesus appears on the shoreline when Peter's fishing, do you remember what's happened? He's heard this. He's also denied that he even knew Jesus. And what does Peter do when he hears and when he notices that Jesus is on the shore? He leaps into the water. And I think the boat gets there before he does. But he was really excited. He leaps off his boat into the water. I think the guy's like, we got wind. Peter's a comic character in the Gospels if you look at it. But so anyway, somehow Peter believed in the midst of all of this, and that's a pretty harsh comment to receive. Somehow Peter was so eager to get to Jesus that there was no fear in pursuing. And of course, Jesus reconciles with Peter. Instead of showing anger or revenge, Jesus says, come, and welcomes him in. And that's a whole different story, and it's amazing and beautiful, and we'll tell that again sometime. Ian and I were just talking about that. The language about Peter's reinstatement is just unbelievable, what happens in the Greek and the words with love and all this stuff. But anyways, this is the point. Jesus had this innate ability to challenge people while letting them know how deeply they were loved. And I don't encourage you to call people Satan. Okay, this is not, maybe we should get that off of the screen. We're getting the wrong idea if that's where you go with this. My point is that Jesus, often in our journey, will actually bring comfort. That's what David says. God's comforting me by the reality of knowing that there will be both correction and love and care all the time. And correction not in a put-down type of a way, but correction in the fact that the Spirit, in John 16, verse 13, Jesus says, the Spirit will continue to lead and guide you. There's this beautiful image of all of that, that it's about the Spirit and the Spirit's ongoing relationship with us. And because of that, David then says, I feel protected and I feel comforted. Literally, that word is about being okay. It's one word, protect and comfort. It's the same word. We just don't know how to translate it. So you will protect and you will comfort me, but by my knowledge of you walking with me and caring and bringing both support and challenge in all of this, that is so peace building in my life. I know that things are going to be okay. That word for being okay, it's the same word. You know, anytime that you say something's going to make it okay, it's the same word in Genesis when Esau is betrayed by Jacob, and Esau gets so upset, and his mother finds out what's going to happen, and she says to Jacob, look out, Esau is consoling himself about you by thinking about killing you. So that word for console is the exact same word that David uses for comfort. So Esau has convinced himself that what will make it okay is by getting back at Jacob. And here's why I mention this, not just because there's a crossover word, but like Esau, we often have this idea that that we're the ones that are going to make it okay when things aren't okay. And we think if we've been wronged, we decide that we're going to make it okay by wronging people. I'll get back at them. I'll make it okay. Well, they said something nasty about me, so I'm going to say something nasty about them. The life Life hurts. There's things that happened to me that wounded me that you can't really explain all of this, but I'm going to walk around bitter, and I'm not going to let other people off the hook because of what happened to me. This idea that what'll make it okay is me choosing to do my own thing, me choosing to make it right, however. And it doesn't have to be that dark either. It could just be that I'm going to grit it out and figure this out, and it's all going to be me. I'm going to change all of the right things, and that's what'll make me peace. If I have a problem in my life, I'm going to fix it. And the story of David is saying, what actually makes it okay in the midst of that journey of growth? And sometimes, yeah, we do need to dig in and make hard decisions to continue to grow more like Jesus. But what makes it okay, what brings the real comfort, is that the presence of God is there fully, loving us, caring for us, guiding us, directing us, no matter what. That's what makes it okay, not us figuring it out ourselves, and certainly not us putting violence back into the world when we experience violence, not putting wrong back into the world when we experience wrong. We respond with the energies of love when people wrong us. We believe that by loving our enemies, we transform them much better than killing them, much better than hurting them with our words. We absorb, like Jesus, we absorb the violence that is done in our world and to us, and we don't rebound it back out into the world. And wow, that changes things, because the cycle of violence finally begins to end. That's, I think, a different subject too. So, okay, the point being, this word is about what will make things okay. And David knows that the only thing that makes it okay, not that everything will turn out correct in the easiest way possible, but that he is not afraid as he walks because the Father is with him. This isn't theoretical. When we grasp the nature of God's presence with us, it changes our entire life and how we walk through it. A number of you know that one of the gentlemen who is a part of this community brought many of us joy. His name is Art, and Art passed away on Thursday. And I know that's news to most of you in this room. But Art was really special in a number of ways. And one of the things that was so special about Art is that that Art had this ability. I was telling his daughters and grandson this morning that Art had this ability to kind of embody this idea of a life that trusts Jesus in such a way that there's just not a lot of fear. Regardless. And there's still a willingness and an openness for both the challenge and the support. One of the things that Art was doing in his final year, maybe more than that, I'm not sure, but he had begun doing something called music therapy with a music therapist. And it was this amazing thing, and he wanted to talk about it with whoever would talk about it with him. And he was taking songs that were speaking to him, and his art therapist was encouraging him to rewrite lyrics for the songs that he loved. And so he would share these with me and with others who saw him. And eventually, I believe that she even recorded some of his versions, and she put his lyrics on little plaques in his house. And it's really beautiful. But the one song that he rewrote was to the tune of Peaceful Easy Feeling. You know that song? I've got a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me down, because I'm already standing on the ground. Is that Eagles? Yeah. Eagles, yeah. And so I took a picture of the lyrics that he rewrote. He kept the chorus. And I found it so profound as I was looking at this message and thinking about Art and his life and his legacy. And the lyrics that he writes are, I found out a long time ago, I love to talk to the Prince of Peace. All but I'm special and I'm at ease. One kind look and all fears cease. And so Art writes in his final months of his life, as a 91-year-old, he's writing about how a long time ago he began to experience that God's presence, that Jesus' presence is what truly casts out fear, really. That the kind look of Jesus puts him at peace. And he grew up in a religious culture that he wasn't at peace a lot because he had to make sure he did all the right things. He would talk with me about that constantly. You know, that there was legalism as a part of that. That there was beauty in knowing God, but there was also this need to constantly be better. And he talked to me about just trusting in the goodness of God in the midst of that journey. And it was so incredibly beautiful. But you know what was special about Art in addition? The guy never, ever stopped wanting to be challenged and grow by Jesus. A month ago, we were sitting in his house. He's on oxygen. And we're chatting about faith and life and degrees and all this leadership in the church. He was a minister. And one of the things he said to me is, we were just talking about something, just another subject. And he goes, yeah. He said, man, I got to keep growing in that area. I'm like, dude, you're 91. God's just got to keep shaping me there. Like, man, the humility that I saw in the longing, both the peace of knowing God, but the longing to constantly be shaped by Jesus, is one of the most beautiful paradoxes that we can possibly hold as disciples of Jesus. To know we are fully loved in every single way, we can rest in absolute peace every night, but at the same time, long for God to continue to refine our spirits and our souls and help us love other people better, help us love the world better, help us peel back areas of justice and compassion more in our world so that the world looks more like God's heart and kingdom, and that we can spend our lives doing that and longing and striving in those ways and yet still be at complete peace because we know that our shepherd is watching and walking. And we feel that sense of that staff on our side. We know that there is nothing, Paul says, that can possibly separate us from the love of God in Romans 8. He says there's nothing, not death or life or height or depth or angels or demons, nothing in all creation can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. Nothing. Nothing, 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 nothing. We have to grasp this because we don't live like this, even if you believe it, friends. Most of us don't live like that. Most of us walk around worried and fearful of so many things because our imaginations run wild. So I'm inviting you to have a different type of imagination. I deeply believe that in the midst of this poem that David began to imagine not just the fears that he was facing, but how he loved and cared for his sheep, and therefore he began to imagine God's heart and care for him. And he began to put those into words. I love that in Luke, Jesus uses sheep language, and he talks about fear. And so in Luke 12, don't be afraid, little flock. To me, that's so not pandering. Like, I look at that, and I'd be like, well, that just seems like, I don't know, like Jesus dumbing it down, you know. Don't be afraid, little flock, you stupid people. I don't think that's the way a shepherd looks at their sheep. I think sometimes they laugh at the sheep's inability or get frustrated at the sheep's inability to follow basic rules, like we've talked about, like stay within the pen so that I can guide you. But don't be afraid. This is right after they're talking about worry and compassion in a number of areas and about the rich, and all of a sudden Jesus is smashing their paradigms because they think that the rich people means that you've been blessed by God a lot more, and Jesus is like, actually, it's really, really difficult for people who are rich to engage with God's heart. It's possible, but it's difficult. And then they're like, well, can anybody? You know, how does this work? And he's like, whoa, stop worrying. You're so full of worry in all of these areas. And he says, don't be afraid, for your Father's been pleased to give you the kingdom. So in light of that, there's parentheses. So in light of that, sell your possessions, give to the poor, provide purses for yourselves that won't wear out. Like, stop holding on to everything so tight and being so worried and so afraid. Love the world with absolute abandon. Love each other. Love me with full abandon. And when you do, you will find treasures in heaven that never fail, where nobody can come and steal that. Even when you're killed, nobody can take that away, Jesus says. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. So set your heart. So the question for us is, what are the things that we're holding on to so tight that we're afraid to lose? What are the things that bring us fear and worry? Where is our heart at? And are we willing to continue to let Jesus move us toward freedom from that fear? What about your life is not free because of fear? What valleys are you unafraid to approach because you might not truly believe that God is with you and that God will provide what's needed and that God will correct and support you along the journey? These are the things that come into David's mind. And so sometimes you just got to say it till you hear it. You know that, right? Sometimes you just got to say it until you hear it. I believe, said the father of a child when Jesus... who was deaf when Jesus healed him. I believe, but help my unbelief. I believe, I think, I'm not sure. I want to believe. Sometimes we have to say it before we can actually hear it. So I'm inviting you this morning to say it. This passage has been used in two different ways by the Jewish people. One way is to look back at the ways that God has been faithful. And another way is to proclaim in the midst of dark valleys how they trust God actively right now to be faithful, okay? And so we're going to actually join into that. On your little handout things, there's some lines on the tear-off portion. And here's what I'm going to encourage you to do. I'm going to encourage you to make your own declaration, okay? And what I mean by that is we tell stories every week. You notice that we didn't do story space this morning? That's because this is filling in for that time. So what we want you to do is we want you to think of one of two things. And you do not have to do this, by the way. But I highly encourage you to. Sometimes we throw around our catch box, which is great, and we can share into the microphone, but then only sometimes our more extroverted people participate. So here's a chance for the rest of you to reflect and offer your contributions to our community. But I want you to think either about a time where you sensed God's presence through a dark valley and you were not afraid. I want you to reflect on that. And if you need more, they're in the back for you if you didn't get one, or if you need a pen. George, you want to bring those pens out for us? Thanks, brother. Okay. So I want you to think, you know, even when I walked through blank, I was not afraid, for you were close beside me. Maybe that's your story. Maybe you want to give witness to something very small and simple, that God cast out fear, even natural fear, fear that's legitimate. Sometimes our fears are legitimate, and God can still calm the seas of our spirits. And maybe what you're drawn to is that you sense that you're in a deep darkness right now of some sort, and you want to say, you know, I'm trying to actively trust Jesus. And sometimes you need to say it before you can hear it. And so maybe then you're looking ahead or in the present. Even when I walk through blank, I will not be afraid, for you're close beside me. So on your little version, you can just, if you're going to tell a story in your one sentence of the past, then you can just cross out the words that are the wrong verb tense. Or if you're going to tell a story and share, even when I'm walking through blank, right now, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me. And I want you to take some time. We share communion every single week. And so what we're going to do is Ben is going to come up in just a minute and hop onto the guitar. And what he's going to do is he's just going to play for a minute and give you a chance to reflect on that question of where are you wanting to trust the presence of God in the midst of darkness? Because God's peace and love is available to you no matter what. Or where do you want to proclaim that there was this time in my life, this thing that I went through, that God brought peace in the midst? You know, one of the things I already mentioned Art, but that was one of the beautiful things, is that Art was at peace. He talked to me each time I saw him in his last year. He was like, yeah, you know, I might die tomorrow. Death's right here. You know, he was completely unafraid, even as he walked through that place, because of his conviction of the presence of Jesus. And how beautiful and how much of a great example is that for us. So, does that make sense to everybody to be reflecting? So what I'm going to invite you to do then is we'll just have a few minutes for you to reflect right now, and then I'll open the table up for you to come forward and take bread and dip it in the juice or the wine and remember the love poured out through Jesus. But before you do that, if you so choose, you can simply say, read your sentence into one of the microphones and then share in communion. You do not have to do that. We don't want to push anybody. Well, let's see. We don't want to put you in a position that is not helpful for your growth. But we're happy pushing you a little bit because we all need to grow. But here's the thing. Your words could speak to each other. And that's what I really want to encourage you to. Your words of where you've sensed God's faithfulness could speak deeply to somebody else in this room. So don't hold back if that's the case. But you don't need to feel guilty. So Ben, why don't you play a little bit? Dwayne, can you make sure that the microphones are on? And let's just be still with God. I'll pray for us and then give us just a little bit of silence while Ben plays. Jesus, we've been talking in a lot of kind of theoretical ways this morning. About fear, but we have our really practical personal realities right now of where it feels like we might be in dark valleys, or where we need to be reminded that in the midst of the dark valleys that you are with us. And Jesus, we trust that your presence goes beyond our situations and our circumstances. So it doesn't even mean that you'll get rid of every single amount of pain in our life. That's not the problem, Lord. The problem is that we need your presence and we need to trust your presence in the midst as we walk through the valley. So we ask you for that. We ask you to meet us exactly where we are when we feel afraid. And we are so thankful that you would never leave, that your love will never wane, that even when we go off track, your care for us doesn't even waver for a moment. Thank you for guiding us up the paths to the green pastures, in the mountains, in the high places.